calls to make early childhood education and care free for families living off low incomes, and Instagram announces teen accounts. Hello, I'm Harrison Peterson of The Latest from NIRS News. The Productivity Commission has recommended that childcare should be made free for families earning less than $80,000 a year, and that others should receive increased subsidies. It's also called for the Childcare Subsidy Activity Test to be abolished, meaning subsidies won't only go to families who work. The report has also criticised the Commonwealth's plan to introduce a universal 90% subsidy for childcare, which would cover nearly the total childcare cost for the first child in every family. The report says the subsidy would be expensive and only benefit wealthy families due to lower income households already being eligible for a 90% subsidy. Young people in Australia will now have teen accounts on Instagram. Parent company Meta has announced all accounts owned by 13 to 17-year-olds will be automatically made private, meaning their content won't be public. Parents will be able to set daily time limits on accounts and will go into sleep mode from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. and young users won't be able to view potentially harmful or inappropriate content. Instagram's Adam Mosari says the platform is acting on parents' concerns.
I talk to parents all the time about their concerns about their teens being online, and I consistently hear three things. One, concerns about who can contact them. Two, what content they see. And three, how much time that they spend online. And teen accounts are designed to hopefully address all three of those concerns without requiring anything from a parent.
There'll be more after this.
Every weekday morning from 9 till 10 across the National Indigenous Radio Service and AAA Murray Country, it's Let's Talk. A First Nations current affairs show through the eyes and ears of First Nations peoples. 9 till 10 weekday mornings through NIRS and Murray Country, it's Let's Talk.
Australia needs tougher environmental laws in order to meet its climate commitments. That's what the Federal Greens leader, Adam Bandt, has told the ABC.
Pollution is going up. We have to act now. Like, the scientists are saying crystal clear that if we're to meet climate targets, we can't open new coal and gas mines. And meanwhile, Anthony Albanese goes to Western Australia and says, look, it's open slather. We're going to keep approving gas mines and we're not going to rein in pollution.
His comments come as the federal government tries to persuade the Greens into supporting its Environmental Protection Agency legislation. The Greens wants the Commonwealth to set up a climate trigger, which would ban mining projects if it poses a risk to the environment. The Prime Minister says he won't support the trigger being added to the legislation. A UN report found over 5,000 civilians have been killed and more than 3.3 million have been displaced in Myanmar since the country's military took power in 2021. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, has called for the crisis to be referred to the International Criminal Court.
There are massive regressions in human rights that have been provoked by a vacuum of rule of law. And that is something that the report tries to highlight in great detail. It is how the Myanmar military has created a crisis by instrumentalizing the legal system, criminalizing nearly all forms of dissent.
The reports also found over 27,000 people had been arrested and that over 18,000 people have died in custody since the coup. The Broadway cast of Hamilton have one of the musical songs for National Voter Registration Day in the US today.
So what happens when we vote?
Well, without a doubt, the black turnout is momentous, especially in the South.
Spread the word and drive your friends.
Rock the vote, then see 6 million new black voters coming from Gen Z. Let's go!
The changed lyrics of the election of 1800 encourages Americans to register to vote and about the importance of being politically engaged. And that is the latest from NIRS News. To stay up to date, you can follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, or visit our website at nirs.org.au.
For National Indigenous Radio Service, for voices of our people.
Did you know that drinking any alcohol while you're pregnant can harm your bub? It's hard to stop drinking, But if you choose to drink alcohol while you're pregnant, it can leave your bub with all sorts of problems that can last their whole life. Remember, pregnancy and grog don't mix. If you need to yarn about it, visit your local Aponipama Clinic and Wellbeing Centre. We're here to help. Our health and our bubba's health is in our hands.
Station sponsor.
Shainan Gimoy Festival returns from the 3rd to the 13th of October 2024. If you miss it the first time, don't miss it now. Experience the tropical foreshore of Gimoy Cairns like never before at our Art Story Walk as it comes alive with a spectacular display of light sculptures. Join us for the Calling Country ceremony on 3rd of October on the Esplanade. Shine is a family-friendly festival celebrating First Nations' unique cultural and arts practices, presenting nightly black markets, daily music performances and deep wisdom conversations at the Salthouse Festival Hub. Be sure to secure your tickets to Shine on Gimoy 2024 and our new Dream Aloud concert at Munro Martin Parklands on Saturday the 5th of October, presented in partnership with QMF. Tickets are available at moshtix.com.au. See you there.
Station sponsor.
Hey, Bill and Gunn, welcome to Black Lord Tribal Edition, and we are broadcasting from the city of Gimoy, which most people call or know as Cairns, and it's a beautiful place to be. And I just wanted to say thank you for letting us broadcast on your country, and thanks to our friends at Bumabipra Media at 98.7 FM. We've got a full lineup today. We've got Bumi, Gunyara and Yirralum joining us today. And we were going to talk about, obviously, the Intertribal Foreign Affairs Council forum has finished, but the focus there was heavily on intertribal treaties. And so we continue that theme today by looking at, I guess, the inside of Australia. Let's say they're having treaty talks all the time. And in particular in Victoria, Sky News did an opinion piece on it not long ago, and Jacinta Price is very concerned with some of the, I guess, transparency or lack of in her view. Let's have a listen to that particular piece that aired last week.
But first, despite a national referendum rejecting an Indigenous voice to the parliament, many states are taking it upon themselves to introduce a treaty and so-called truth-telling anyway. First out of the blocks, no surprises here, is Victoria. Over the weekend, a treaty event billed as a public meeting was held in the Melbourne suburb of Greensboro. Sky News reporter Georgie Dickerson went along to try and find out exactly what was happening.
Putting a focus on First Nations issues. This community forum in Greensboro, northeast of Melbourne, was organised to educate locals on treaty.
It's very important, it's critical. It's time we woke up in this country and started to learn the truth of our true history. We need to work with them, or as they say, walk with them.
Almost 300 people registered their interest for the event. Q&A discussions were a central aspect of the forum to answer the community's questions and concerns.
Two reasons: to find out more about what's proposed as part of a treaty, and secondly, to hear what other people have to say.
How a treaty will work. I think lots of people have concerns about what a treaty might mean, and from what I've seen so far, there's no real reason for anybody to be particularly worried about it.
Opportunity for face-to-face discussions, I think, are really important, because it's so easy to have social media, all sorts of media content that we get these days that is very curated, very siloed, and it just kind of builds people's engagement with what they're already thinking.
Many people Sky News spoke with on their way to the event were already supportive of the idea of treaty in Victoria.
Most of the people I talk to and know do want this to happen. and it's really important for the country.
Way overdue. It was promised a long time ago.
I think it's really important that we begin to engage in a really detailed way with the First Nations people of our country and to recognise what our entitlements are and what their entitlements are.
Sky News attended the meeting today with the intention of filming the forum for news coverage. Unfortunately, our request to film the event was denied and we are unable to show you what happened inside. Proponents of treaty in Victoria say it would help put practical frameworks in place to implement better policies and give First Nations people a greater say on issues that impact their everyday lives.
It's something that's going to happen in Victoria, hopefully, and you want to bring people along. You want people to understand that every single nation on earth that has involved colonisation has made a treaty with the indigenous people, and all of those countries are doing fine, and there aren't it's not a problematic thing. And the fact that Australia hasn't done it really makes us stand out as a country that's kind of hiding from its past.
Treaty negotiations in Victoria are due to begin later this year. This process is designed to determine what is included in treaty. That framework would then be legislated in Parliament.
Hopefully there'll be a strong message that they'll listen to.
Georgie Dickerson, Sky News, Melbourne.
All right, for her take, I'm joined now by Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, Senator Price. Well, welcome. First of all, obviously, the media were blocked, but you can see from everyone turning up there, Jacinta, I don't think there was one person that had any scepticism about a treaty. And I remind people at home, Victoria voted against The Voice last year, even Woke Victoria. This is all done with public money. Why the secrecy?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that should be the first red flag so far in this process. It should have been made public. It's a publicly funded event. This is going to affect all Victorians. You can absolutely see the naivety from those attending. But, what's concerning is the lack of transparency in this process. We also know that the First Nations Assembly only had a 10% voter turnout to elect its members. So can it legitimately say it is a representative body of Indigenous Victorians? And you can already hear the language being used by those attending is a real us and them approach. I mean, we are Australian citizens, Indigenous Victorians are Australian citizens. There shouldn't be this us and them approach. That certainly this process is ingraining that division within communities.
You can feel the game, though, get these state treaties up, don't ask too many questions, have these little forums. I mean, 300 people in Melbourne's not a big number to get along to something. Don't let the media in. Be able to say, as they will after that meeting, everyone was in support of it. Push it through the Parliament. You'll get it through the Victorian Parliament. And then the Prime Minister will be compelled, once there's a number of states with a treaty, to say, well, look, if all the states have got a treaty, we really need one at a national level. He won't put that to a referendum. And all of a sudden we'll be where we voted we didn't want to go this time last year. Mm.
Oh, yeah, it's really deeply concerning stuff, and especially when you've got a body that's claiming to be a representative body with such a low voter turnout. It's like this what's underway in South Australia at the moment with their legislated voice. Again, 10% voter turnout. Where's that going to go to? You can't suggest that with these sort of shady closed door events and this inability to provide account transparency, that this is actually going to be a true democratic process that heads toward legislation and this legislation process. But we all know that Mr. Albanese is sitting in the background waiting for all these states to conduct, their treaty processes and then ram it on through. Mm. And Australians should be very concerned. This is going to affect every single one of us. But we know that there's governance issues, there's accountability issues with many organisations. Why would we want to extend that further through this process?
Over the weekend, this is going back to the Blaney gold mine, over the weekend the Australian had a letter, an explosive letter, It showed the claims of ancient camp ovens, possible burial sites, an initiation area near the proposed mine were all examined and then dismissed as having no authenticity by Indigenous elders representing the local land council. This is an ongoing issue, Jacinda. It's still dogging the minister. Surely we've got real problems here that these new and emerging groups may or may not be at all representative of those with a long recognised Aboriginal leadership in a particular area, are somehow getting primacy over the groups that, in this case, the Blaney Mine had been dealing with for decades.
Absolutely. And this is the concern that is taking place. This is why we need to take a closer look at Native Title, at things like the Aboriginal Heritage Act, the Heritage Act that I know that my colleague, Senator Dunningham, wants to look closer at to review, because we can't allow a situation where we get false claims being made, pushed by activists who are anti-development, who just want to bring an end to, a lot of these projects that we're seeing. I mean, when the minister wants to override and disregard the legal entity, the Orange Land Council, who have disproven these claims and listen to a group that is a registered charity, not actually a representative group of the traditional owners.
Well, that's an interesting position. Ganyara, obviously, a lot of support there, it seemed, from people actually attending that particular workshop on Victorian Treaty. But ultimately, as we have said before, Australia, Indigenous people inside of Australia, for example, 3%, and the rest are 97%, and it's always going to be an uphill battle.
Yeah, but if we quote Professor Craven and Anne Toomey, they're not treaties. So why are they using the word treaty, which is pretty concerning to me? They're definitely not treaties. In the true sense of the word, as Craven said, Professor Craven said, going back now, 7-8 years, that they are not nations, they're not treaties between nations, nations that won't exist, treaties that have no power and authority. So what are they really? You know, they're just having some sort of agreement between the Victorian Aboriginals and, or the Aboriginal Victorians and the rest of the Victorian people. So yes, you can use what, as I said, you can use whatever word you like, but these aren't between sovereign nations, not treaties in the true sense of the word. Too right, Jacinta Price should be concerned about what these agreements are. But in saying that, most Australians, and you can hear it there, most Australians are for it, but they're very uneducated about what it really is. And it's this sort of disinformation and misinformation of calling them treaties that should be very concerning to everyone. What's going to be included in these treaties? Because as we discussed there a while ago, like the Yorta Yorta Nation, who's in Victoria, and by the way, they haven't taken up their seat, as far as I know, yet at the Treaty Commission. Their country is split in half by the Murray. Now, one half of their country is in New South Wales, the other half is in Victoria. So whatever is done in Victoria won't apply in the top side of their country. So how does that work, you know? So there's a lot to be ironed out of this so-called treaty agreement, whatever it is. Don't call it a treaty if it's not a real one.
Yeah, I think it's really important that people understand that, we've had other people in the industry and we've called themselves service agreements, I think, is quite a fair call. We had Mamaki Wawa from the Gunditjmara who attended the forum also, who spoke about, yes, while there is that talk of treaty in Victoria, it really isn't, from his point of view as well. It's sort of salad dressing. But Yirilam, I think it's very important that these are done correctly. We sort of had that conversation recently on the territory, and most people are prioritising intertribal treaties to make it easier for the UN to treaty with the mob here.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a good example of what Ganyara was just talking about. That's a correct treaty where you've got two sovereign nations making agreements between each other. And, you know, I've always liked the analogy that our Attorney General's used. You know, it's like if you want to make an agreement with somebody, you don't make it with their children. So, you know, if the states want to have meetings over this, well, it's a good education maybe, as long as you said they're not using the word treaty, because it's not. It has to happen between each of the many nations on this continent and the people who arrive second, Australia.
Bumi, the Australians have been talking about treaty all the time, but really Yidinji's not going anywhere in terms of it's not going to move from here. It's going to always going to be here. And that's something that Australia has to come to the Yidinji table now, yeah, to come in and try and do business with us.
Yeah, like we got our radio on now. Yidinji get the radio on, and I don't know how you had a lot going on out there. Should have a radio too, so we can hear what on the other side or up top end, you know, or the up top end. But you know what I mean. What's going on there? Yeah, I went down to Adelaide, had 2-3 days there. It was good. I told that bloke at the museum there, I said, well, you stole it. I said, I need my things back. He said, oh, you're going to wait for 10 or 20 years. I said, that shouldn't be. And I said, see, that's for me and my brother. We never cry for anybody's toy or anything. You know, we bought our own stuff, and I told that fellow, I said, I need these things back to have answered my parents. And I'm here today to just look at it and go home. Come here sad, go back sad. We seem to live that life when they were in trouble. You got wet tropic, you got land council, you got all this and that. You know, we don't need them, you know. We don't need them, they need to go. And in that real sense, you know, with... See, like I said to on this show and edit, you're going to give me something, you know? You're going to really give me something. You know, I never had it on the table. I don't want to talk about that all the time, but, well, that's good. You know, we're still here. We're still going to talk, and we need you lot to talk too. Yeah.
So, Carl, I'm just going to make it clear that you went down to Adelaide to the Museum of South Australia there in Adelaide, and what things did they have of your families there? Can you go through some of the things you looked at and look?
Well, they had 2 shields there. My dad and Fred Mundery's shield, and had the shield that there was some other shield there, and there was a windmill net that crossed wild at Boomerang, and cooker stick there. Cockle stick and the headgear and Murmble and the claptic we had there, Vibra, and there's one shield there that they took me upstairs that I said, no, that's one of mine. It had no name on. So they put the name Dingy on it, and there's a few other stuff there too. But there's a lot of stuff, but they had all our stuff there, Dingy stuff. And it was very good for me to see that things, you know. It's been a long time now. I'm 70, and I've been going into Brisbane, but nothing was there. It was right down there, so came back the other day. And
you also saw some video footage or film footage. What was that? That was quite special for you too.
Yeah, that was a film of Dad. Straight over Yarraba Cross, even Fred Munderby was standing upon the beach and showing the sword and the shield there. And Fred was painting and he was making another shield there. And so there was a corroboree place there. Yeah, there's a few other people there, but I could see it right. The video doesn't talk, it just, you can hear that Matt, but it's a good film. So, yeah, I should maybe have it in 6 months' time. They're going to send it back and a few other things too.
Gagnaro, it's important that this Yidinji property is given back. But it's just as important to have a safe space to put them in. Obviously, we don't have that yet, but I think a Living Histories Museum would be something that the Yidinja Nation would really appreciate. And those things are obviously in the motion of developing, these are our ideas and our desires to give these special cultural items and even repatriated ancestors and things like that a place to rest.
Yeah, look, it's pretty important to get your head around the fact that these objects and persons were stolen. These bodies were taken. They weren't given willingly to the British or the colonial world at the time. They were stolen. And it is stolen property, but this is what's so important, why you've got to bring your nation back together and bring it back into play. Who are they going to give it back to? You know, remember a few years ago they had to repatriate a Yidinji elder, an old fella from the German museum. It should have been given back to a Yidinji citizen, not back to Indigenous Australians, you know, and that was a very important thing. So you've got to bring your nation back into fruition, bring it back to life, revitalise it. And these, as Uncle's saying there, he would like to get some stuff back. These are the terms and conditions of negotiating a treaty. Okay, we will negotiate a treaty, and this will be one of the terms and conditions of it, that these artefacts that belong to the Yidinji Nation and his family come back to here and be held securely, done properly, you know, for forever and a day, so they remain intact. You know, not going to be just squandered or jammed in some basement in some museum to be never see the light of day. So this is how you negotiate treaties. What's going on down in Victoria, I feel, may not cover such items as that. You know, they may, but the museum, being for Victorians, will be held in Melbourne, not where we would say it should be held here. And Adelaide Museum has no right to be holding any property, by the way, of Uncle here and the family. So let's negotiate the treaty properly.
Yeah, the very first time I spoke properly with Bumi was in Ngambri Territory, Canberra, and they actually were visiting that museum down there because there were artefacts from London that came that time that, the late Gudju travelled to London in the last few years ago to have a look at all the shields with the riddled with bullet holes and they're still over there. So that's what I'm saying. There's a time where these things have to be taken and given back. And now I just see Denmark have given back a tribal cloak made out of feathers of a bird to a tribe there in Brazil now. But at the same time, the whole world has to give back what's in you, not just, you know, how do you do that with all the shields? But what about all the gold and everything else that was taken from here? They got to give that back too. Yerulam.
Well, you know, everyone's really happy to do, and let's talk about cultural stuff and things that the other world, the UN world, doesn't value. As soon as it's something that you mentioned, gold, that's why I was laughing, because suddenly that's a different topic. But you know, I like to hear reinforcement of the reason why. So, you know, Ganyara was just talking about setting up your nation so these things can be properly given back to you. But, you know, that's a continued discussion, and especially from an education perspective, of what it means to be set up your own nation, because then whose identity do you have? You know, do you have just an Australian identity? Because correct me if I'm wrong, Ganyara, but if you set up your own identity, whose law are you under? If you set up your own tribal identity, who are you obeying?
And there's the problem for Australia. There is the problem, because they don't have permission to be here yet. They don't have permission to have our stuff. They got no permission at all for anything. And actually, I'll tell you now, right now, they're acting contrary to the Charter of the UN. The UN, the international order that recognises Australia as a member state, that lot. Australia is acting contrary to the charter that recognises them. So they're not a very good citizen. And when you put it all together with the stolen property, don't mention the gold because that's worth money, but don't mention the gold, but they've got to give it back, or the value of it, but don't mention it. But whose law? Under our law. Whose law was first here? Our law. What has Australia got to offer for a treaty?
Well, that's right. So if you're using the Australian ID, then Albanese is your boss. And, you know, I don't have an issue with that. The problem is, though, for Mr. Albanese and the rest of the Commonwealth of Australia, is that Yidinji is back. It has its paperwork, it has its government, it has its personalities, it has its elders who have created the government in their true and correct capacity, and they're doing it in a way that is in accord or in line with how one would go about that. Now, Matt Quartrip, the professor that spoke at the Inter-Tribal Foreign Affairs Council Forum, basically listed off the Montevideo Convention, the permanent population, the ability to enter into foreign affairs, and having, you know, what was it? The other thing is territory.
You've got territory, population, and, you know, the ability to enter into foreign negotiations, which Yidinji can.
Yeah, so, you know, Bumi, you know, does Yidinji have land?
Oh, yeah.
Does it have a permanent population like Mobi, Obama?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And you can talk to other tribes?
Yeah.
So there you go. That's on a tribal level now, but we're saying on a paper level, we have the police minister, cultural affairs minister sitting down here. We have the attorney general. We have the minister for social affairs and for education and foreign affairs and trade here. So in a modern context now, the Yidinji Nation can go out on an international level and display its colours on its vessels and its using its instruments to coexist and move around and partake in business if they want to.
Well, Yirilam raised a very important point there. Under whose law? And that is an important thing to be pointing out. Who's subject to whose authority? Who's on whose territory? Because if they're on our territory, they're subject to our law. If we're on their territory, we're subject to their law.
Well, the 3% again, isn't it? So if we do talk about the 3% of Australian citizens who are the original people from this continent, and you ask that 3%, I pretty guarantee you're going to get at least 99.5%. Say if they had a choice of another law, it wouldn't be that one that they're under.
which is rather sad in a way, I suppose, you know, because it doesn't reflect good upon the Commonwealth of Australia and its current situation where it's appearing to be acting contrary to the Charter of the UN, which it is, by the way. If you read Resolution 1540 and 1960, the General Assembly resolution, it says very clearly there that any manifestation of colonialism is acting contrary to the Charter of the UN. And Australia is, because Australia was never colonised. The Yidinji country was colonised. As Uncle said there, there's pictures of them sitting over there on the beach doing their stuff. And hang on a sec, they're very dark-skinned. Who are these white fellas on the country? Oh, that's the leftovers, that's the dregs, that's the manifestation of colonialism, that's the law system that's here. What identity were them old fellas using over on the beach? Oh, they were using the Yidinji one. Oh, not the Australian one. Oh, so that's now we've got two worlds sitting here. But yeah, one has permission to be here and one doesn't.
Well, one belongs here and the other one can be here, but it has to talk to the legal entity that was created by the elders, which is the sovereign Yidinji government in this case.
Well, you're talking about a treaty. That permission. Permission is from a treaty.
Yeah, and that's why we had that article from the Sky News team there talking about, you know, the perceptions of treaty inside of Australia. But I'll come back to Holy Scriptures, and the very simple one was that Joseph, a Jewish man, a boy, who was sold into slavery by his brothers, traded him and gave him to an Egyptian family. His name was Potiphar, and he was quite high up in Egypt. But they couldn't have Joseph there, so they had to give him an Egyptian name. The same when you go in Australia, let's say that's Egypt, for example. So Bumi is the tribal name, that's Joseph, and then that Australian name or Egyptian name is Peter or David or whatever it is over on that side. So there's two worlds there, but Joseph, who was acting as Zaphnath-Paneah, he went to second in charge in Egypt, but he couldn't be the boss because he can't be the boss. Only he could be the boss on this side. And that's where we're talking about now is Bumi and Jamablum. And when you hear these names, Bulir, Gudabalam, all these names, they are the bosses for Malambara or whatever group that they are connected to. That's the difference here, and that piece of paper that they play is the ace. You can't beat it. It's the number one card. Australia can produce all the kings and queens it wants, but it can't beat the Yidinji top card, and that's the difficulty for them.
Oh, absolutely. Look, we're not interested. Just you raised the issue of Israel. It just reminded me, we're not interested in the two-state solution. We don't want a membership of the UN. That's Australia's role, by the way. Australia will be appointed for and on behalf of the Yidinji Nation. If they enter into an agreement, maybe it might be the Chinese, or it might be the Russians, it might be the Americans. We don't know who will enter into an agreement if Australia doesn't want it, which is very important. We need to do our stuff. We need to do our stuff as tribally as possible, you know, like what we are doing, bring back the old laws and revitalise them and look after ourselves. If you read Articles 3, 4 and 5 of UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, it makes it very clear that we can revitalise all our stuff, get all our stuff back, by the way, under the treaty that that Australia doesn't have, and, you know, appoint Australia to go out and, on our behalf in the international affairs. We don't need membership within the UN. That's Australia's role.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very simple. And Bumi, you know, most of the people that we are used to and good friends with, they use that Australian piece of paper, so we want to look after them too if they want to use that Australian piece of paper.
Yeah, well, that's what the tribe is all about, see? Yidinji and Cook Island, Jabbagai, and, well, like we say, it's coming, but we should, this paper, I'm a bit jarred up here. Yeah, that, this paper business that, you know, when you're a sovereign tribe, you still know that you're a sovereignty, that we never carry paper in, you know, like we was initiated in there. But we know and know that we know each other, you know? That's power in us, you know? Yeah. So that's why I hate you when you walk around in town, you know, they're still around and all this and that. And, yeah.
Well, I think it's the paper is what the rest of the world uses. So if someone from Afghanistan or someone can come here and they've seen one of the Yidinji Wama painted up on a shield, they don't know those things. They don't know the binal, the shell, is money. They don't know those things, but when you put it on paper, they can read about it. And that's the identity of Ganyara and everything else we're doing now. So instead of walking around with body paint on, we can carry a piece of paper saying, hey, that looks... It's easy for them to say, oh, that's Malambara, or that's a Yidinji, or that's Kunganji, that's Jabbagai, that's Kugiyalanji, that's Najinji, or whatever it is. It makes it a lot easier for them because they're used to the pieces of paper.
And that's part of the reason why we use English, by the way, on just about everything we do. We can go and use language if we want, but not many people can understand it. I think there was an issue during World War II where a couple of Indians were using language because... no one could break the code. They thought, oh, they're using some top secret code. But they were just using an old Indian language that they understood, that they could converse with each other, but the enemy couldn't, you know. So it's the same thing. We would have this. We would be facing the same problem. People can't understand the Yidinji language on the other side of the world, you know. So we've got to use English so that we can put to the world what's going on, who we are, what we're doing, what's it all about. So, yes, Yidinji is the language group. But English is the official language at the government level, not the tribal level.
Yeah, so I think Professor Asmi Wood made that very clear at the forum, saying that, look, if you want to, you can just speak in your language and identify as yourselves. But if you don't speak an official language of the UN, then no one can understand you. So you can't really convey your concerns or you know, what you want, your desires. You said if you don't speak Chinese, Russian, English, or whatever it may be, French, Spanish, then you're going to... And he's right. Not everyone can speak Yidden or understand all those things. But we certainly are now talking in English because it came here as the property of the Yidinji Nation, the spoken word. So, you know, at the end of the day, let's use it to full effect. And anyway, you're listening to Black Lord Tribal Edition right across the country today. Thanks to our friends at Bumbapipra Media, 98.7 FM. If you're listening inside the Commonwealth, then it's probably via the National Indigenous Radio Service. We'll be back after the break. Well, one of the guests we had at the Intertribal Foreign Affairs Council Forum was Professor Asmi Wood, and I spoke with him in a pre-recorded interview soon after that took place, and I hope you enjoy it. Asmi, thank you so much for joining us, and the Intertribal Foreign Affairs Council Forum has finished for this year, but I guess what were the highlights for you, and I guess how, what do you hope for the future, for next year's event?
Honourable Minister, thank you for inviting me to this program. Peace and blessings to your listeners. I think meeting as sovereign people, as communities, as countries, as nations, is a very powerful step in asserting our self-determination, as self-determined people, and showing the characteristics of a self-determined group, and inviting others to do that has been a very empowering thing. And seeing other nations follow Yidinjambiri Gaba in what you're doing has been really empowering.
In your experience and journey in the field of law, let's say, how historical, or has this happened before in your mind, something in this capacity at this level before, or is this something that is quite new for this continent in a modern day context?
I think it's unique in many ways. There have been other nations that have entered into treaty with each other, entered into treaty with colonizing entities. So in that sense, in a theoretical sense, it's happened before, but in a practical sense, where you're not only asserting sovereignty but performing sovereignty, which is really important in international law, and that persistent objection that is important in international law, that you object to how your people are being treated by the colonizing entity, by invoking things like the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, by invoking the decolonization instruments of the United Nations, is very powerful, and I don't think it has happened in a practical sense. I mean, people have written about it, I've written about it, as you know, and others have written about it. But this is a practical demonstration of how it works.
It is. And I think from our point of view, and we've always tried to take... because if we look after the Commonwealth of Australia, obviously we look after your office and everyone else's. I think it's a very gentle way that we approach it for doing it. We're here to fulfil the law, not to destroy it. I think that's a really important thing to remind everyone, is that the sovereignty of the Yidinja Nation, I can speak for, is here to protect all the businesses, all the people that currently reside on our territory. But that's something that's also unique in that I don't think we're seeking UN membership. We're not interested in that. I mean, if Australia is doing it, it's already there. Our position is, well, how about you continue that? But let's have that formalised somehow in some sort of agreement.
I won't speak to the Yidinji position out of respect. You know, clearly it's you know, you have senior people speaking for your community. But speaking from an international legal perspective, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People talks about not affecting the territorial integrity of this continent and how it's represented. So we are working well within... I'm not Yidinji, but... I like to consider myself an honorary member of your community, you know, as Yidinji, to work within the territorial integrity, still asserting your rights as self-determined people, asserting your rights as sovereign people, and again, performing self-determination and sovereignty, and objecting to those elements of colonization which are oppressive.
How do you theorise? I mean, people like yourselves and many others talk in this space in terms of the legal universe inside of Australia. How would you see that coming to fruition? Is it through some sort of a trusteeship or a formal agreement, like a treaty? How would you see this possibly happening in the future?
I think trusteeship has a very particular meaning under the United Nations, so I'll leave that term out of it because of its particular technical meaning. But I think communities, countries, nations, peoples, asserting who they are, what they are, and as you spoke in your opening address, talking about the Montevideo Convention and how, you know, Yidinji are performing the requirements under international law of the rights, your rights as a people, your rights to peoplehood, your rights to legal personality, your rights to a legal personality that is recognized everywhere, is, you know, reestablishes your connection with your past and with your ancestors. And it shows that colonization is just a blip in the in the flux of time. It's something that has happened, but you are connecting back to who your people were. And the way you spoke about the particular areas within your own territory, about which side of the territory, which sides of the mountains, how you connect back to your history, is incredibly powerful. And it is a demonstration of your intimate knowledge of your territory and how you control that territory from the past, remembering the past and taking it into the future, because you talk not only about your grandparents and their connections, but you talk about your son and how he carries it forward. So that continuous link is an amazing link to the past and into the future.
I know that decolonisation may take place in the future, but I know the King of Australia, Charles, will be making a trip to this continent in October as such. Have you ever thought about how Australia might remove itself from or finally, I wouldn't say decolonise, but take on a new shape where an opportunity may exist for Indigenous statehood and recognition? So maybe a form of a republic or something like this. I know that Greg Craven was the head of the Reformation of the Federation Committee at one point there. I'm just wondering, how do you see Australia maybe changing shape in the future where Indigenous statehood and recognition can, I wouldn't say coexist, but they're respected?
So I think it's important to look back into the history of the United Nations. When countries like Britain joined, countries like Britain, Australia, countries in the international sense joined the United Nations, the Soviet Union asked for 5 votes rather than 1, because it said countries like Australia, New Zealand were not independent, but they were part of the British enterprise. So in return, countries like Soviet republics like Kazakhstan and Georgia and Ukraine, I think Soviet socialist republics, had a vote in the United Nations. So if you look at it from that point of view, those countries didn't see Australia as anything other than part of the British Empire. I think Anglo-Australians have been trying to assert their own identity by talking about republicanism and all of those sorts of things. But the reality is that the King of England is the king, though in the right of the Commonwealth, is the King of Australia. So I think this is an issue that they need to sort out between themselves. But for Indigenous people on this continent, I think it creates an opportunity of saying, well, you're trying to move away from the British, your mother country. It gives us an opportunity to watch what they do and creates perhaps a precedent and a model for how Indigenous people can also use similar language and similar approaches to assert Indigenous identity, Indigenous legal personality, Indigenous international legal personality, as happens within the Commonwealth and its relationship with its mother country.
Do you think it might be something similar to that of the Russian Federation? I know that there are other, let's say, even though they're sort of inside of the Federation, the Karelia, and there's other smaller areas in the Federation that do have some sort of historical identity and society-based identity. Is that something you see may take shape here, or is it too difficult to deal with all the different mobs in one go?
I think historically there are differences between what the Russians as the inheritors of, you know, the legal personality of the Soviet Union in terms of the veto and things like that have done. But they do have multiple languages, multiple races, multiple peoples coexisting within the Russian Federation. I have written, I'm not sure if you've read that stuff, about how we can have what's called horizontal sovereignty, as spoken by His Honour Justice Jacobs in one of the cases in the past. So I think it's possible.
Yeah, and that's possible because I think the potential solutions to to remedy the situation that we're in. Even John Kiff, from the former IMF expert, saying that Yidinji's currency could be a complementary currency. I think that can interact with the international world, but not necessarily be subject to a lot of the complex laws and legislations and multilateral agreements that Australia is bound to, for example.
I don't understand economics. I heard what he said. He's worked in that realm for a long time, and he seemed to think that everything that was happening here was perfectly practical and perfectly lawful. I think, having a currency, as he spoke about, where was he from? Devon, did he say?
He was from a former IMF, International Monetary Fund.
Where he lived.
He's in Washington, Baltimore, Washington. USA.
Oh, sorry, not. Who was the other gentleman who spoke at the conference? And
Phantom.
From the Britain. Yeah. No, from Britain.
Guladu Stonycroft.
Yes. And he talked about their local currency and how their local shire has created, local currency to promote local businesses. A lot of small entities are doing this, and I don't see what Yidinji is doing is in specie different. I mean, the intention behind it is different about, the history that you have. But in terms of its practical application, it seems to promote local trade and businesses more than anybody else. I don't know why anybody in Gimoy would oppose what you're doing, because what it does is bring business to this community, as they were doing in Britain and in other places, as he explained.
Yeah, so let's move on to, obviously with the failed voice and the referendum and things like that, one of the... what do you... And I know it's difficult to predict things, but how do you see the coalition, for example, if they were to win government in the future, how would they... What are some of the conversations you think they may be having, and how to address this matter? Because it's not going to go away, and even Labor having a go, it didn't work. What other options are there, you think?
I think the leader of the opposition promised to have a second referendum on the voice. Slightly different model, a legislated voice rather than a constitutionally entrenched voice. Let's see what they do and whether they keep their word on that issue if they go through. I think many elders have spoken about the pluses and minuses of a voice. I think the Labour Party probably has burnt a lot of political capital, I guess, in running this issue. And, 61 point something percent said no, which is a huge number of people. But 40% roughly said yes, which is also a large number of people. But in an election sense, this was a landslide no. And, many people are going to continue with similar kinds of things. It's very different to what Yidinji are doing. Yidinji are actually performing self-determination. It's not waiting for permission from anybody to do it. And I think that is what self-determination really means. We will determine what we will do. And if Yidinji people are saying this is what we're going to do, that is self-determination in practice. I think the voice is not really self-determination in a sense that it's a pan-Aboriginal... It's always going to be a pan-Aboriginal organisation speaking for a lot of groups. It's self-determination maybe to some extent from that big picture point of view. But, there are 250-odd communities here. Self-determination, to my understanding, is more about individual communities being self-determined. And the way Yidinji are working with other self-determined communities, to me, fits more within the international meaning of self-determination in its meaning, in its international instruments, than perhaps the voice. There may be different expressions of the same thing, but to me, what Yidinji are doing seems a lot closer to the international meaning of the term.
Yeah, I think you could sort of look at the history of ATSIC and others where they were sort of, and rightfully so, if it's created by the Constitution, then governments should be able to control those things, but even though it may not be the right thing from a moral point of view or ethical point of view, whatever, but even things like state-based treaties, you know, there's so much divided opinion amongst the academic world that, you know, it does... people are for it, people are against it, and, you know, you can do this, but ultimately it's still within the domestic realm, let's say, of the Australian legal universe, which is, you know, I think has its benefits and but obligations as well.
It has its benefits and it has its downsides as well. With a state-based treaty, only the state legislature can alter the terms of that treaty. The Indigenous people or the communities don't have that legislative power. So I think it is lopsided. But on the other hand, it gives people experience in dealing with these kinds of issues in the legislative realm. And I think what you're doing is, I think, perhaps more in my understanding, a lot more advanced than what is happening in the treaty world. You have treaties with other Aboriginal communities that is performing self-determination and not waiting for what in effect is a colonial legislature to tell you what you can and can't do. You're doing what, you know, this is up to you, this is up to your people. And it's up to your people to tell you if they don't think that what you're doing is right. But you're speaking on behalf of people. I can see that your people are united. I can see that they're coming together and falling into this group because it is a democratic, it's a consultative process. I think you have really strong, wise leadership, which is a blessing to your community. You know who you are. You know what you want to do. You want to do the right thing. You don't want to cause any harm. You want prosperity and education for your people. Who can argue with that? I mean, isn't that what we all want for our children and our parents? You know?
Yeah, and I think that's stability and security, let's say, is something that I think the world would need and Australia would need. I think there's so much going on at the moment on a geopolitical level. There's a lot of uncertainty with economies and blocks and wars and things like that. I think from our point of view anyway, from a Yidinji point of view, it's really about how can we minimise and have a sort of frictionless transition or something where there is some sort of Australia can truly speak for on behalf of the Yidinji Nation at the international level, at the UN, for example, while we go about our business and they help us interact with the rest of the world. I think that's what the UNDRIP document is really simple in outlining that, and I think that's where we're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, UNDRIP is a great start. It's the minimum rights that should accrue to Indigenous peoples. But I think, as His Honour Justice Brennan said, and you said in your speech, and was repeated by the Honourable Attorney, was that there is a recognition by the Commonwealth that it was Aboriginal resources, Aboriginal land, Aboriginal the Aboriginal continent that underwrote and continues to underwrite the prosperity of the Anglo-Australian system. And I think all you did was to invoke that and to ask them to continue to do what they're doing, but perhaps to treat people more fairly in terms of the sharing of resources. But you're doing it through law, you're doing it through discussion, you're doing it through diplomacy. Again, all this falls within the ambit of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. It's a document that the Australian Commonwealth has endorsed. And yes, they haven't put it into domestic law, but this is something they should do. But all you're doing is to ask them to honour their word. And what's wrong with that?
Asmi, it's always wonderful to catch up with you. I think there's a real need, and maybe you can elaborate on this a little bit more, about, I think, nations who are interested in in a philosophical exercise, looking at setting up their nations and their legal entities and all those things. And we touched on this last year with the Birrikaba at the ANU College of Law, treaty making and the process, because it can be quite an intense, protracted exercise in real life, because there are so many things to consider when you're doing treaties. For example, I didn't have time this particular event to talk about data sharing arrangements and things that are really important and modern immediate issues. That's where learned scribes and lawyers are really important, because they can then help define or create documents or suggest ways of quickly addressing those things and doing it in a win-win manner that everyone comprehends in that, those two parties.
These are complex things, and they're complex instruments, but I still like to go back to what you said in your welcoming address, and that is that we as Indigenous people, or sorry, you as the Yidinji Nation, sorry, I shouldn't have used the term we, you as the Yidinji Nation, are entering into treaties in good faith. You are entering with honour. You're entering with every intention of keeping